the Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic jungle.
48, of course, was the year which I'd say we've all been dining out on ever since.
It was a vintage team. We had everything. And of course, with Jack Kyle. He's a genius.
This must be it. This must be it for Ronan O'Gara. Drop it, goal. Grand Slam at stake. He's got it.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is possible.
Teddy Thomas. Space in front of Thomas. He could go through the middle here. Teddy Thomas for the line and over he goes. Some ground being made now. Sexton from outside the 10-metre line. It's spinning. It's spinning. Jonathan Sexton has made it. He has snatched victory from the jaws of defeat for Ireland.
C'est terrible. Terrible.
Carberry. And it's an easy opportunity for Stockdale. Stockdale has Earls inside him if he wants to use him. He may not need him, he doesn't need him. And he runs in the second try of the afternoon. Sexton, wonderful pass, and Stockdale finishes. Anscombe, the intercept from Stockdale, and he'll race away to send Ireland to victory over the Welsh. Peter Moore, oh, that's an intercept for Stockdale, and he'll race clear. And he gets his fifth try of this NatWest Six Nations Championship. Bundiaki, Ringrose, Stockdale. Stockdale scores in the corner. He makes it look so easy. Murray for Stockdale down the left-hand side. Stockdale past Mike Brown. Oh, and it's just got away from him. Has he got it down in the end? Another Irish try right in the stroke of halftime. It's 11-9 for this 21-year-old from Ulster.
It's extraordinary stuff, isn't it?
And unless England come up with the goods at the Stade de France, Ireland will be champions by the end of the night.
That's going to be it. It is knocked forward. It is a victory for France in terms of this game. But the big victory today is Ireland's crowned the Six Nations champions for 2018.
Nine years out from the heroics at the Millennium Stadium in 2009, Ireland looking to repeat something that's only ever been done in 48 and once this century.
My heart is in my mouth, really. I think it's just an incredible setting. To win a Grand Slam here would be phenomenal, but it's going to take a huge effort from Joe Schmidt's side.
Sexton straight into the air down on top of Watson. Here comes Kearney. Well, it's been put down. Well, he eventually got there, Ben Skeen, and Ireland have got the dream start at Twickenham.
What a start, what a kick from Sexton.
Through the middle, and it goes. Bundiaki inside him to Stander. Stander almost over. Stander is over. There's the full-time whistle. Ireland and Joe Schmidt, they join the heroes of 1948 and 2009. Grand Slam winners. On St. Patrick's Day at Twickenham. What a story!
The Triple Crown, the Six Nations, the Grand Slam. Ireland have done it all, and at Twickenham against England in the most convincing manner. We're going to be looking back on it all for the next little while with Dennis Hickey, who has joined us in studio, and Johnny Murphy, who is snowbound in Kildare, but is going to join us on the line as well. Dennis, you were there yesterday. It was a day in many ways without drama.
It was, yeah. It was notable, I think, because of the Ireland dominated so much. I thought even at 60 minutes the game was up, and in the stadium you got a sense from the crowd, the English crowd, I was kind of looking around, people getting more and more frustrated, people leaving early. Their worst fears, I suppose, were confirmed, because I think because England had been on the road for two games. Yeah. there was an expectation, and it was certainly an expectation I shared going into the match, that playing at home would be different. They'd be different. It's a very, very difficult place to win, Twickenham. And I think the English support are kind of seeing things unfold in front of their eyes, what they've been watching on television, very, very disgruntled and very disillusioned, I think, leaving. And as I said, there's a lot of people leaving before the end, which you don't usually see in Twickenham.
Can you put into some sort of context just how big an achievement this is, a third Grand Slam title, but also the first time since 1972 Ireland have gone away and won in both France and England in the same season?
Yeah, you know, winning the Grand Slam is well documented how difficult it is, clearly, because of the lack of wins. But I'm pretty sure most of those wins have come when their fixtures have been the other way around, when England played England and France at home. And to go on the road at the start of the tournament, play France away, and obviously win the way that they did, and then those three games at home, and then having to go to England for the finale, does make the achievement, I think, all the more significant. I think I certainly was a little unsure if I think after watching Ireland playing the three games in a row at home, you do kind of get lulled into a false sense, because, you know, when you see your team playing at home, it's very different to playing away. And they were so good in those games at home. Not infallible, you know, in every one of those games they had patches where they were kind of left at the end of the game thinking, we've got to work on this bit, or, you know, we'll work on that bit. You know, the Scottish game, obviously, they created a lot of chances, didn't convert. Wales, you know, with 10 minutes to go, you're wondering how Wales is still in the game. So they had lots to work on, but when you get used to watching a team playing at home, you kind of start thinking they're maybe a little bit more invincible than they are. And then the real test comes when you go away, because it's such a change. And for a team that gets used to them playing at home, to go back on the road. So the fact that there were the Grand Slam has been bookended by those two away fixtures, and they won them in such a fashion, was would have been particularly satisfying for the players. And give them great confidence for the years ahead, when they know they can go into very hostile environments and win.
So to be able to go to Twickenham and deliver that calibre of performance, and to be so disciplined, to make so few mistakes, in a way, has Joe Schmidt almost taken the emotion out of Irish rugby? The playing at home, as you say, so often with that crowd behind you, you can get yourself pumped up, and quite often the opposition can't live with it. Whereas the way Ireland play now, they're not reliant on that. Either at home or away, they have a set style of playing, and they know they can go out and execute it, really, no matter what the venue is.
Well, I think Ireland played with a lot of emotion yesterday. They played with a lot of passion. I think that was one of the contrasts, I thought, between the two sides, is that England, you know, watching the game in front of you, you know, sometimes on television you can not pick up on those sort of things, but I thought England looked flat considering they're playing at home and they had so much at stake, you know, losing three games in the trot. I thought they would have played with a bit more passion. I thought they would have picked a team that maybe could have played a bit more passion, guys like Mike Brown, who always brings a lot of that to his game. And they were a little passionless, considering it was on the line for them. Whereas I thought actually Ireland, you know, they've mixed both the technical excellence, which they have.
It's controlled.
But they really played with a lot of heart yesterday, and they played with huge amounts of passion, particularly at times when they were defending. You know, the Irish defence, you know, talk about the tries, and the tries are fantastic, but the Irish defence yesterday was incredible. And everyone was willing them not to concede a try at the end, because they had defended so well. They defended a period. I know England ultimately scored in that first half, but they were under the cosh for 10-15 minutes.
With Omani in the bin.
Yeah, with Omani in the bin. England were going for driving mauls, and they managed to be able to keep them out no matter what. And again, that just showed to me that there's a lot more than just, you know, a very well-polished, a very, you know, technically and tactically well-drilled team. They're certainly not a team of robots. They certainly played with a lot of heart yesterday, and you need that, I think, to win the tournament.
We were discussing it before Dennis came in about how there's clearly Joe Schmidt's mark all over everything that this Irish team do, but that, unlike some teams, more of the credit goes to the coach than the players. That it doesn't really matter what player is injured. We seem to be able to cope now. If we lost Sexton or Murray, we may have more of an insight into exactly how much depth we do have, but everyone seems to be interchangeable, and that is because of the coach and the system that he's put in place, that the system fits no matter who has come in.
Well, I think it's fair to say, true to say, that Ireland has the best squad in the Six Nations, not just the best team. And I think maybe in years gone by, certainly probably even in 2009, you would have said Ireland had the best team. But, you know, squad-wise, I think this team is way ahead of anything that Ireland.
Well, in 09, was it the same 22 for every single game?
Yeah, I think it was 18 players started the five games.
Yeah, something like that. Whereas, obviously, throughout this year, Ireland have used a lot more players. But this, to your point, it doesn't. The performance of the team isn't diminished by losing one or two players either. From the start of the match or even interchanging during the game. And one of the things that Ireland have been able to withstand, and they withstood it magnificently yesterday, was a lot of disruption. They had a lot of guys going on and off, and that kind of changes the concentration, just goes slightly when you have to make it changes the combinations right up to the end when Kieran Marmion was coming on the wing, which he's actually had to do before, if I remember.
Against Australia. Yesterday, I said it was against England, but I asked him after the game.
Yeah. He's actually Australia had to do it before, two caps on the wing.
So, what does that say about Joe Schmidt? Obviously, it says an awful lot about the players and their ability to be flexible and adapt to these extenuating circumstances. But you finish the game with a scrum half on the wing, a fairly small guy, but physically isn't afraid of anything, and a 20-year-old in Jordan Larmour outside Gary Ringrose, who's 23, which one of our listeners is correcting me, said he was 24 earlier. And he said after the game, Joe Schmidt, that he had spent no time working on Jordan Larmour as a centre.
Yeah, you could see.
That's not surprising.
Because when I actually saw him coming on, I was thinking there's no way he could have played or done any sort of work at centre, because he's barely played for Leinster. And he's played very little even on the wing. He's played a lot more at full-back. So the fact he was in playing in the centre in a match of that importance, I thought he played really well, because I think it suited him as well at a time where England were trying to stretch Ireland, and because they had to score, and they're throwing the ball around. Larmour was able to use his pace to just track people down, of which he has a lot of. I think it just... The team, the squad, is at a certain level whereby everyone is very comfortable, clearly, with the systems they play, and has the skill set to be able to execute under pressure. So they're in a very good place in that respect.
Let's go to Johnny Murphy, who is listening in. Johnny, give us your thoughts on what we've been saying about Joe Schmidt and the style and the way he's been able to get this team playing.
Yeah, I think you just look at the back row and you look at Dan Levy's performance yesterday. Dan wasn't a starter, and there's been a few injuries, but I think, you know, he pushed Tadhg Furlong all the way for the man of the match. I just thought he was absolutely immense. He's just created depth everywhere. I think probably Dave's right in terms of, when he says that if something did happen, Connor or Johnny, then there might be a small difference. But Joey Carberry's come on twice in two really important games and closed the game out quite well. So, yeah, their depth is unbelievable. I think yesterday, massive thing for their defence, you know, to hold out for that 10-minute period or to defend like they did when Pete O'Mahony was off the pitch was incredible. And that's been something that they've been getting a lot of flack for over the last 4 days, over the last 4 games, in terms of, you know, the defence out wide and how much pressure they're under and where they've conceded those tries. So it was a huge performance defensively as well yesterday.
What was different, Johnny, about us in those wide positions yesterday? Because it was a massive day for Andy Farrell, wasn't it? Some of the system that he was putting in place were being called into question over the last couple of weeks, and maybe in a fair way justified, because we had conceded a lot of tries in those wide areas. So when you watched us yesterday and you're talking about how our defence has improved, where did you see the improvement? What were the reasons behind it?
I think we just completely dominated the ruck area, and England kept on making silly decisions there. They lost kind of the referee again in terms of the amount of penalties they were conceding. That enabled us to get a really good fold and to keep bringing that repeated line speed that Andy Farrell wants to try and bring. And then we didn't have really too many decision-making errors out wide. Our connections were good. We turned our shoulders at the right times, and we hunted the ball correctly in terms of our hunt inside. We kept coming forward, and when they did duck back inside, they were getting hit really hard on the behind the gain line. So it was just, it was kind of an amalgamation of three or four things that they've been trying to get right, and they all kind of folded into place throughout the game yesterday.
The three tries, all very different, but did they show all the very best aspects of Ireland's play, being able to identify weaknesses and potential weaknesses maybe for the first try with putting some pressure on the fullback straight away from Sexton, the genius of the move for the second try for CJ Stander, and then just having that moment of clarity just before half-time. Firstly, to keep the ball in play, to go, as Ireland have done throughout this championship, to try and get another score just before half-time. But the awareness of both Murray and Stockdale to spot the gap on the inside to take advantage of it. Does all of that look as though it's stuff that's very much pre-planned, stuff worked on the training ground?
I'd say probably the last one is probably the one that's kind of just off the cuff. They see a 2v1 in the edge and they just take it. The first one I'd say is definitely pre-planned. Anthony Watson wouldn't be renowned as as secure under the high ball as Mike Brown would be. So that was something that they wanted to test early, obviously. And then I read this morning that they've run that play actually against England before, but about 3 years ago, and it worked. I think Robbie Henshaw managed to get over the line as well, so they just felt that the defensive system hasn't changed enough, so they said if it worked once, let's do it again. And I think that just shows you the analysis that probably, and the depth of the analysis that does go on behind the scenes to, you know, Mervyn Murphy's background team, Joe himself, and that they feel that they can, you know, that they can enact and plaid twice, even though it's worked for them, to just say, yeah, let's have a go again and do it.
I just thought it, yeah, just on that first try in particular, the kick, the distance and the height of the kick, again, maybe off camera, you wouldn't have seen, like the wind was very swirly in the stadium, and it was absolutely inch perfect, the kick right on the try line. And Watson, I'd agree with Johnny, isn't as renowned under the high ball as he is going forward. It would have been very, very difficult for any fullback to deal with it.
It was right on the money.
And it just gave enough time for Rob Kearney to get in the air and just block the line of vision just for a split second. So the execution was perfect.
Do you look at the way Ireland play and the way Leinster played down the years under Joe Schmidt and think, I would love to have worked under him as a coach with the level of detail, the clarity you would have had going onto the pitch?
Well, yeah, like I worked with some very good coaches in my time in Leinster and I was very lucky to do so. But yeah, he's clearly, you know, certainly been the standard bearer in terms of coaching in Ireland in recent years. And the fact that his style has adapted, I think, more to international rugby than probably provincial shows that he, you know, realises exactly what's required to be successful. International rugby is different to playing week in, week out. And the fact that they have a game plan, that a platform certainly that they're able to use and then vary certain aspects of it depending on the opposition. Or, you know, that try, that the CJ Standard try, they've tried that move already this season in Six Nations. It didn't work, I think, one of the times they tried to use it, but it's incredible to be able to, you know, with the way the teams are set up with the pods and they go at the back and they have forwards, but it's just amazing how much the game has developed when the fact that, like, every team can play these balls out the back now. That's not a differentiator. Every team or rugby at all levels, club and country, play those pods and the ball out the back. But the fact that you can actually build a game-winning move around a tight head prop, slipping a ball to you know, on a dummy feed to a centre to lead to a try in a game of that importance with that much pressure, just shows you, A, how good Tadhg Furlong is, but also how far the game has come.
Who's calling that decision for that move at that time?
I'd say they call that before the ball goes into the line-out. Yeah, they call it in, and it's up
Sexton,
to...
Sexton, is it?
I don't know who would call it. I don't know who calls it. It's probably Sexton calling that this is a move, but I wouldn't say there's much calling to be done in the sense that they know, as everyone knows, this part of the pitch is a move. This is a move they're likely to do. They probably would. Would they only do it off a left hand line? Maybe they do. I think everyone would know this is the part of the pitch where we play this move. I don't know exactly what way they would call, whether he slips it to the centre or he gives it at the back, because they do variations of the same thing, which keeps teams guessing. Or is it just up to Tadhg Furlong at the time to give to whoever he wants? But I would say they probably pre-planned to pop it.
And, I mean, you would have been part of teams that have spent hours trying to execute a particular move on the training pitch, and when it comes off in a game, and a game of the stakes of the one we watched yesterday, how much satisfaction does that give you?
Well,
you've just, in the moments after Standards got that try.
Well, I can tell you, I never played on any team where a game and a a move of such intricacy would have gone through a tight end prop. I never played in any team, which would have been the linchpin of the move would have been dependent on that. And that's no reflection necessarily on the guys I play with, but it is a reflection of what a good rugby player that Tadhg Furlong is. You know, he's an exceptional. I don't think there's any other team in the Six Nations who have a tight end prop who could play that move. But the fact that he's the linchpin, teams' defenses don't think he's going to do.
Well, that's the fact that it is him is key to the move. You know, we were saying earlier, it's this supposed overuse of the loop involving Sexton. Mm. So maybe turning that weakness into a strength, and then the unsuspecting tight end prop forward in the middle of the field is just expected to truck it up and take the contact. I mean, that's all part of the move. The whole thing is concocted beautifully.
Yeah, see, what Ireland have is a huge amount of nuances off every single one of their plays, and this is why they're able to retain the ball so much. This is why they're you know, the possession stats, I don't know what they finished up by yesterday. They were 60% at halftime, but in the French match, I think they were
46%. I think England, but obviously maybe their dominance and having so much possession in the last sort of 10-15 minutes.
Well, it must have literally swung around those two periods, because Ireland, I think they had 63% in the first match against France. They had 65% against Italy, 67% against Wales. So they've dominated possession, and it's because they retain the ball so much now. Mm. You know, you can retain the ball by popping one-off runners and just holding onto it and going nowhere. But what Ireland are able to do is they have very nuanced plays, and they have three or four different options every time. And Ten gets the ball, go at the back, he can pop it to someone, a forward can pop it, forward can take it up. So all of a sudden, instead of it's not off 9 or if it's off 10, there's kind of 13 or 14 variations that they're able to do, and everyone is able to play depending on what's being called. To be able to do that over 30 or 40 phases, as they were shown they were able to do it in Paris, and they did it at times yesterday, took England through numerous phases, even in the lead up for that try, just the Stockdale try. That's why they're a world class team.
Yeah, Johnny, on what Dennis is saying there and about the nuance in Ireland's attacking play at times, the two words in all the analysis that seem to keep coming up time and time again is how clinical Ireland are, but also the clarity with which they play the game and the clarity they seem to have of the game plan. And going back to last week, Paul O'Connell after the game against Scotland saying that he feels Ireland can bring a different level of aggression than any other side because there is such clarity. Everybody knows what their job is, so then they can go and they can go attacking everything in an even more ferocious manner. To get that level of clarity at international rugby when you don't have the players every single day, I know they get decent camps together, but to get that level of clarity, is that the greatest achievement Joe Schmidt has managed during this campaign?
Yeah, I think that was a kind of an eye-opener for any non-Leinster player when he took over. I remember I was in camp for the last 2 weeks when they won in Paris, and I remember speaking to Andy Trimble, and I was like, oh, he'd just come back kind of after a small bit of a sabbatical, and he was playing the rugby of his life. I was like, oh, how are you enjoying it? And he's like, it's been the most frightening 4 weeks of my life so far. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, everyone does analysis and you go through the day, and when your downtime in previous camps, it would be your downtime, where your downtime is you're analysing what you have to do and how you're going to do it. So he's just brought that through 5-6 years now, and I just think that everyone has that clarity, so they don't need to work. All they need to do is concentrate on their aggression levels and make sure that they can be in the right place at the right time. They know they're going to be there, so they then just have to be sure that they have that physical edge. Like that, everyone, one of Joe's biggest thing, most people will know where they're going to be for the first 4 or 5 phases, and then as Dennis says, they have, you know, 3 or 4 different shapes, but they've got multiple options off it, which means they are quite unpredictable. I know the media kind of is like, well, you know, they play quite boring rugby, but it's so clinical and so concise at times that it is, you know, it can be undefendable.
Mm. There, you look through 1 to 15 and there's a lot of interesting stories among every player. I might almost go through them in sections. And that, starting then with the front row, you touched on Tadhg Furlong and being that world-class tight head, but also Keane Healy, all the injury problems he's had, going from a position probably 18 months, 2 years ago, where he might have been fearful that he might have to retire. And then in the centre of them, Rory Best and his captaincy and the way he stepped up over. Can you talk about those three and the real influence they've had on Ireland's progression?
Yeah, absolutely. We talked a lot about Tadhg Furlong already. He's, you know, I think he'd probably be himself, Sexton and Murray. Certainly if Leinster have a strong European Cup, he'd be there, thereabouts, for World Player of the Year, I would say, by the end of the season.
Is Furlong
is he a freak that Ireland are lucky to have, or is he actually, when you look at these systems that are in place in Irish rugby that have been developed over the last 10-15 years, is he almost a prototype of that coming to fruition?
I think it's a bit of both. I don't think you could create a player just out of the system, a player like him. Obviously he's a very skillful player. He is an incredible athlete. Like, he hauls 20 stone around for 60-70 minutes, and I was watching him yesterday before they took him off, and because I was thinking, I wonder if they're going to bring Andrew Porter on. But the impact at collisions, the impact, the clean outs he was doing, like up to the minute before he was taken off, was almost as intense as it was after the first couple of minutes. So he's a phenomenal athlete, you know, to be able to do that, to be able to have that athleticism and engine just to be able to keep going, considering what front row fours have to do, pushing, scrumming, rucking, etc., lifting, and then the presence around the field. And he's got great hands. Clearly, he's got great hands. He's a very good footballer as well. So I don't think any system could just create a player like that. I think he has the best of both worlds, really. I think he's an innate footballer who's come through a system. He's also a huge man. Like, he's a huge, huge guy.
Outside of Sexton, is he the most valuable member of the team?
I think so. Well, Murray and Sexton, I think, and Furlong are the three most. I think for Kian Healy, he's kind of one of the elder statesmen of the team now. He's had a very illustrious career. You know, he's had a lot of success, and his I was going to say his duel with Jack McGrath, but it seems to be more of a partnership that they have. You know, they seem to get on quite well, which in itself for front row competing players is quite unusual. But because I think the modern game, they both expect to play.
So do you think they see it that way?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they see it that way. But
the player who's starting might see it that way.
Yeah, well, you know, because I think as well, because it's been swings and roundabouts, they've both had their time in the sun.
You would wonder, Keane Healy watching Jack McGrath over the last year, how much that's had to do with the upping his performance.
A huge amount. But I think the fact that they, you know, they both play in every game, both for Leinster and Ireland, just sometimes one starts and the other doesn't. So, and the way that, certainly the way the squad system with Leinster in particular, is that, you know, they both start probably a large amount, almost an equal amount of games, and they both play in an equal amount of games, just depending who starts. But it's great to see him come back this year, and he's been able to build on a very strong season. I think having a full pre-season last year as well would have really helped him with his injury issues.
Is it a part of the genius again of Joan that the two of the replacements for the front row yesterday, they were so far out of favour in November they could barely get near the matchday squad, let alone start against the likes of Argentina and South Africa? And that's Sean Cronin and Jack McGrath. Like, we were asking questions around November, what has happened to Jack McGrath? Why is Joe not favouring him in any way? Is it a Lions hangover? Sean Cronin had fallen certainly into third position, if not fourth, in terms of the hookers, and yet their impact over the last couple of games have just been brilliant as well. Like, their appetite has been fired up again, because they were pretty much told, you need to go back and improve.
He makes them work. He's clearly a coach who makes people work for their position, and they all are prepared to put in the work, and they know if they do perform, they'll get picked. I think Jack McGrath at the end of last year, for me, looked like he was, I think the Lions came at a wrong time for him. I thought he looked tired by the end of last season. He played a lot of rugby. He played a lot of 80 minute matches at Loose Head Prop in the two seasons before, the first season when he broke into the squad, and then last year. And I thought you could just see by the end of the season he was one of the players a little bit tired, and I think it was natural then at the start of the season he got off to a slower start. I think he needed a bit of a break, and he got the break, but he was a bit slower. Keane Healy hadn't been on the lines, you know, pre-season training, etc. So I wasn't surprised to see, but I think there's very little between them now, which is a great position for both Leinster and Ireland, clearly. I think for Rory Best, I remember when Rory Best took over as captain, and I was thinking to myself, this is interesting, because Rory obviously was a one of the younger players in the squad when I finished up in the last match. He was on the bench, I think, for that game, and he was still a personality within the squad, certainly seen as a kind of senior Ulster player even at that stage, but he wasn't necessarily a standout candidate for being captain, certainly when in 2007. But it's amazing. I was very interested to see then how he developed, and it was a very, you know, I think Ireland had been used to very kind of totemic figures as captain up to that point. You had Keith Wood, certainly, you know, during my time you had Keith Wood, you had Brian O'Driscoll, you had Paul O'Connell, and even though the bulk of Paul's captaincy was after I finished, he had filled in a couple of times, but he was the clear next captain. You know, I didn't think that was a surprise. But they were very, as I said, very totemic figures. They were very clearly the best players on the pitch, from an Irish perspective, clearly recognised as such by the opposition. And Rory Best was a different type of captain, and I was always curious to see how that would work. But actually, I actually think the team is much more evenly led now. I think it's actually been
so
one of
the role
key...
of the captain maybe isn't as significant as it once was.
I still think he's certainly the team's captain. They all refer to him with that respect. But because he's not the Brian O'Driscoll type, or because he's playing hooker, he's a different dynamic, and he's a different way about him. And I actually think the team is much more balanced. I think the leadership is more spread, and I think the ability is more spread. There's a number of significant leaders in that team, and I think it's been one of the keys to their success. The fact that he has got the respect of his team, he's led them to. And what he's achieved, actually, no other Irish captain has achieved. You know, you think, again, when you think about the great Irish captains, or you think, you know, you look at what Brian achieved, or you think what Paul achieved, or Keith Wood, to that extent, none of them have had the success he's had all combined. You know, he now has the Grand Slam, beat the All Blacks, first captain to lead a team to win a test down in South Africa. A lot of firsts as a captain. So he's actually the most successful Irish captain.
Yeah, Johnny, is that one of the big changes from 2009, that maybe when we think of that team, it is about O'Driscoll, O'Connell, O'Gara, the clear, obvious leaders, whereas right now, squad depth-wise, it seems to be the load is shared somewhat?
Yeah, definitely. I think if you watch games live, you know, the amount of conversations that happen between Johnny, Connor, even Peter Rob Manny, Kearney, yeah, to an extent, you know, Peter O'Mahony, they all talk. And it was interesting yesterday, you know, you had three guys, the last three guys on before they lifted the cup were Johnny, Pete, and then Rory lifted the cup. But Johnny and Pete lifted the Triple Crown. And I think that was, you know, I think that's significant, you know. And you look at Rob Kearney was in for a lot of flack, kind of over his position, and then put under pressure from Jordan Lamar and then the whole Zeebo thing. But he was immense yesterday. And I think that leadership and that know-how is the whole way from 1 to 15. They obviously have leaders in every unit, and they're all very, you know, they're all very important. There's a senior player group, the likes of Keith Earls, he's involved in that, you know. So there's leaders littered the whole way throughout the squad.
I think as well about Rory, he strikes a sense of kind of a paternal figure. He's not a shouter and roarer, and you know, it's all about him. It's all about him as the captain. He's a really really lovely fella. And even as a younger player, he was, you know, a very warm kind of character, very approachable. Would talk to everyone, and you could see him in that role as someone, you know, he really is the elder statesman, and he's been through a lot, and he has that respect of all the young players. And you've got to remember, this team has, I think there was 10 guys yesterday played 25 and younger. So it's a very, very young profile team, which is fantastic for where Ireland are going. Yeah. If you think about 10 of the team being 25 or younger, that's an incredible statistic for where Irish rugby is going to be in a couple of years.
I know we're 7-8, and we're conscious that we're talking to two wingers about how these front row players are going and how well they played over the last.
I've listened to many front row forwards talk about back play and wing play. I can tell you over the years.
But Johnny, we were talking about, you know, the valuable players in the squad. They're obviously all valuable, but in terms of guys we can't afford to lose, and we're Furlong, Murray and Sexton were the three. But you look at the hooking positions, and by the time Japan rolls around, Sean Cronin's going to be 33 and Rory Best going to be 37. Are either of those, or both, or one, in your eyes, going to be playing in this World Cup? And if one or both are not there, would you be worried about what's coming up from behind?
I think Scans, obviously in Munster, he was in the mix there, and then he got injured. But it is probably one of the positions that we probably lack a tiny bit of depth in. Rory signed a new contract, looks like probably till the end of the World Cup. So, you know, hopefully fitness permitting, he gets there. And I think Sean Cronin doesn't show any signs that he won't be there either. So, but it is important that they do stay fit. Outside that, you obviously have Rob Herring and James Tracy, guys who have relatively little exposure, so there probably might have to be a small bit more opportunity given to those guys throughout. But it's important that they try and get game time for their provinces to start off, and then after that, that they, if they do get an opportunity, they take it. But yeah, it's probably one of the areas just with how important those two lads are. But then again, like people were saying, you know, during the autumn, we did pretty well during the autumn, and Sean Cronin wasn't involved at all. So there is probably a small bit more depth, but it is one of those positions that, like 9 and 10, you would be a small bit wary that if we lost someone, then there might be a tiny bit of an issue.
All our Six Nations coverage on Off the Ball is with thanks to Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us. We have Dennis Hickey in studio, Johnny Murphy on the line as well. There's a lot more we want to get through and go through some of the other lines in the Irish team and just how well they've performed and where we're going to head from here looking towards 2019, but we'll take a quick break.
The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.
Welcome back to Sunday's Off the Ball. Nathan and Dave in studio. We're joined by Dennis Hickey as well. And Johnny Murphy is still on the line. We are reflecting on the Grand Slam. If you haven't heard and you're planning on going to the Aviva Stadium, well, head back home, sit down. You can probably relax in front of the TV for the afternoon because it has unfortunately been cancelled because of the weather conditions. Johnny, we've been talking then about the front row and maybe the age profile of the two hookers heading towards 2019. One area where we don't need to worry about the age profile and something we could be really excited about is the second row and the emergence of James Ryan and Ian Henderson as well, who maybe has been overshadowed a little bit by what James Ryan has done during this championship. I remember during the World Cup there was a few concerns about what you might lose from Henderson's game as he moves from the back row into the second row. Those concerns seems to have completely evaporated.
Yeah, definitely. I think he just offers another dimension from the second row. James Ryan has been immense. Probably a surprise that he, to some people, that he got kind of the shot ahead of Devon Toner, but yesterday he it's his double, triple, quadruple efforts in a time that, you know, his engine just looks incredible. But he has the skill set as well. I don't know who's calling the lineouts at the moment, but I think
it was Henderson. Johnny was doing it yesterday. Just looking down on the field at it.
Yeah, well, you see, like, there's obviously an intelligence level across the second row then that they can all call the lineouts, especially with someone like Dev coming off the bench. So, yeah, that's certainly an area. You know, you look at the guys that's the thing, like, the amount of players that have been used throughout the last, you know, even the Six Nations. You look at Quinn Roo, he featured, you know, Ulton Delan, there's loads more.
Tadhg Byrne coming back.
Tadhg Byrne as well, you know, so there's a huge amount of depth in that area. You know, Ulton Delan is someone that, you know, 2 years ago we thought he was going to be a starter for the years to come, and injuries and then just the emergence of James Ryan has just put him on the back burner a small bit.
Yeah, James Ryan followed in the footsteps of Brian O'Driscoll, made his Ireland debut before he made his Leinster debut. And that can be difficult when there's so much hype around you and so much expectation, and you are in your very early 20s. Not every player can go and deliver on that, but to not just deliver, but to step up during the Six Nations, and suddenly it's either Henderson and Toner alongside Ryan.
I watched him, and certainly at the opening exchanges, for a guy of his age, 21, he's incredibly physical for a second row of that age. You know, usually, considering he's going to get bigger in the next 2 or 3 years, he'll be a lot bigger than he is now, because he's a very lean frame. He's a very, you know, 6'8". There's a lot of frame which he's going to put weight on it as he gets a little bit older. So even by the World Cup, he'll be bigger again. But with respect to the level of physicality in the exchanges, right from the off, he was made a couple of really, really big hits. And Henderson is the same. Like, Henderson is one of these guys who, you know, he's not a shouter and roar. He just gets on with a huge amount of work. And held up the English attack at one point for a critical turnover for the referee to call a maul, so Ireland will get the put in, and he does a lot of that for Ireland. And two incredibly valuable players to build a team around. And Devon Toner has really stuck to the fact that he's obviously been displaced in the side, but he's made an impact, I think, in every game he's come on, because he's very difficult, clearly, for a sub hooker, and he usually is a sub hooker on. He's up against, you know, sort of for George to come on, and then Devon Toner comes on, and straight away he's got to navigate the 6'10" player who Ireland could throw up. It's a nice secret weapon to, well, not much secret, it's a nice weapon to bring on when the sub hooker is trying to find his feet early on after being brought on. So I think that between the three of them, and as Johnny said, the other guys who aren't there, they're very strong in that position.
It's probably a credit to the consistency of performance of Peter O'Mahony and CJ Stander that actually we haven't spoken a huge amount about them during this Six Nations.
Sorry, I just meant to say, by the way, at the end of the match I was watching James Ryan run up and down on the touchline, giving high fives to all the supporters, and I was thinking to myself, you know, 21 years of age, 5 matches for Ireland, never lost one of them at a Grand Slam, you know. He must know what he's
doing. As we were saying, he's never lost a match for Leinster either.
He couldn't possibly understand what he's achieved at this stage at 21. You can't do
it. What is it saying about... Clearly these guys are physically primed and conditioned coming out of the school system. We're way ahead of the rest of the pack in a lot of ways, that you can almost throw them into the professional ranks when they leave school. But it's emotionally, mentally, nothing seems to faze them. Like, he's gone up against George Cruz and Maro Itoje. Now, granted, Itoje's only 2 years older than them, but he's so much experience. He's a British and Irish Lion. Yeah. Up against Alwyn Jones in the game against the Welsh. It just seems that no matter what it is that you're willing to throw at James Ryan, he just flicks it all away, and he's absolutely fine about it.
Again, he's been a captain of underage teams, so he's leadership qualities that probably belies years, you know.
Yeah, Johnny, on the back row then, maybe we've come complacent because we've so much strength and depth, but then you only have to, and you look at most of the leading teams in world rugby, the back row is an area of real strength, but you watch the way England have had an absolute disaster at the breakdown, and with their back row players struggling for form, maybe we should give more compliments to this Irish group and Dan Levy's performance in particular, but also the guys who missed out. Josh van der Fleer going to be out for the rest of the season. Reese Ruddock, who we know Joe Smith is a huge fan of and will certainly be thinking of forcing his way back in as well.
Sean O'Brien.
Sean O'Brien.
Heaslip having to retire.
The list goes on and on and on. Jack Conan as well. Like, it's frightening the reserves that Ireland have in place now in the back row.
Yeah, and all playing really well for their provinces as well. It's not a, you know, it's not a form issue. There's at least 7 or 8 guys that you can have a conversation about whether they're going to start or not. And yeah, it's just incredible. You know, the likes of, you know, even the guys up in Ulster, you know, that, you know, have been capped, Sean Reedy, Chris Henry, these guys, they're completely forgotten about now, but they were only used within the last 12, 18 months. So yeah, it's just the back row is a frightening area and something that we definitely have a lot of riches in.
Mm. Do you want to get to a stage by 2019, Dennis, where you know your starting back row, where it's nailed on who the three are going to be, or do you want to keep this level of competition right up to the start of a tournament?
Yeah, no, I don't think Ireland needs to do that. I think, as I said, the reason Ireland are the Grand Slam champions is because they have the strongest squad, not because they have the strongest team. And the reality is people will get injured, and across the board, and in the back row in particular, it's very attritional. And we could be talking about three completely different player system next year.
And we never mentioned Ian Henderson and Ty Burden when it comes to back row options, both of whom have a very good chance of playing in those roles if absolutely necessary.
Yeah, Ty Burden's introduction to Irish rugby is going to be very interesting to see where he fits into all this.
Yeah.
Go on, Johnny.
Yeah, no, and you look at how he played last week against Leinster over in Parky Scarlett. He got that penalty last minute that enabled him to get a draw over there. Like, his performance levels over the last 18 months, 2 years have just been incredible. He's actually probably one of the most unlucky guys not to even have had an introduction into the squad, given that he has given a commitment that he's coming home, you know.
Yeah. Talk to us, Dennis, about Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray then, the level of performance and their role within the team. Has it changed this Six Nations compared to the last 2-3 seasons?
Well, I think to have one of those two playing, being the leading exponent of their in their field would be remarkable. But to have two of them playing so well at the moment, there's you know, obviously there's Bowden Barrett in the Southern Hemisphere to rival Johnny, but apart from that, it really is just the two of them. I think Owen Farrell has slipped down the pecking order after kind of indifferent Six Nations. He's a class player, clearly, but it didn't really happen for him in the Six Nations, and Dan Biggar had his issues as well. And Finn Russell was kind of hot and cold, so it's really those two are head and shoulders. But I think Conor Murray, for me, is the best number nine by some distance at the moment. I just think his all round game management, he never ever looks like he's under any sort of stress. Now that's also a function of the work that Ireland do around ball presentation and the speed of the ball compared to even England yesterday, where Wigglesworth was digging the ball out so often, whereas Murray gets the ball presented to him so easily. But he's an incredible all rounder. He has every facet to his game. He's got a great pass, inch perfect box kicks.
Such a danger around the fringes as well.
Such a danger around the fringes. He's very physical in defence, so he's perfectly at home and clean and get a ruck, and now can kick goals. But he really is the complete player. He really is the complete player. You know, it's the fact that Ireland have him and he's playing so well, for him, if he was to get injured, touch wood, would be a disaster. But I think the way the two of them are playing together as well, they've really kind of forged a really strong partnership there. And you know, that's what I think all the other teams are missing.
But our depth has improved at nine, hasn't it? Even in the last 6 months, we knew Kieran Marmon was coming on bit by bit. I'm not talking about, you know, putting Conor Murray in a position where he's under pressure for his starting slot, but the season that John Cooney has had in Ulster, and Luke McGrath was just going brilliantly until he picked up an injury. So you would hope that going into 2019 that maybe losing Conor, God, we hope that won't happen, but if you were to be in that position, that we're not actually as hard up as we might have been.
No, I think, you know, I think there are all those names that you mentioned have been playing well for their provinces at different times. I just think the gap is so big because of the quality of Murray, as opposed to
it certainly the lack of quality
below him. Yeah, I just think he would be a hard position to absorb. But, you know, hopefully we don't need to have that conversation.
Johnny, I know you got ahead shortly, but just a couple of questions before you go. Just on that backup then for Murray and Sexton, Ireland go to Australia during the summer and have a huge amount of momentum behind them. Mm. Do you bring your first choice group and Murray and Sexton, or do you actually think World Cup 18 months away, let's leave these guys back at home, let's give them that rest, it'll serve us well in the long run, you get the younger players a bit more experience, but maybe you end up losing a bit of momentum you get from the Six Nations?
Yeah, I think he's probably going to go full out, just because, you know, you need to have the experience of winning in the Southern Hemisphere. The majority of them have done it in South Africa. They've beaten New Zealand, obviously. So I think Australia is probably something that for this current crop, and I know guys have done it before, but they're really, you know, that option has to be there to add another layer to the squad as an entirety. You know, you're lucky, and a lot of Ulster people gave out about Ruaidh Pienaar and the fact that he left, was made leave. But that opportunity that is given Cooney, it shows that the IRFU and their protocols are in place, and they work. You know, we have four live options at nine. Dennis is completely right. There's no way that people are going to be putting pressure on Conor. He is just that far ahead of the game. He's probably the best in world rugby. So, but we do have depth there, and that is down to the decision that the RFU have made, whether you like them or not. But that depth is there going forward.
Good stuff, Johnny. We'll let you go. Thanks a lot for taking the call. Johnny Murphy.
Cheers. Thanks, many
snowbound
guys.
In Kildare. You can go and build your snowman now. All our Six Nations coverage on Off the Ball, with thanks to Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us. Dennis, what would you do going to Australia then with Sexton and Murray? It's a difficult conversation to go to Johnny Sexton and say, you're staying at home for the summer. It's the best thing in the long term.
But it is the best thing in the long term, isn't it? Like, you saw how well, obviously Paddy Jackson hasn't been available this time around, but how well Paddy Jackson, a number of other players, Tiernan O'Halloran, Luke Marshall, they were superb in South Africa. When we had no Johnny Sexton.
I'm not sure, actually, to be honest. I think that there's a logic, clearly, to keep the momentum going and winning a Test Series, or trying to win a Test Series in Australia. And it's still 18 months out. I think...
Are Ireland actually in a different position there in comparison to other countries, that they can bring Murray and Sexton and then turn around to the provinces and say, actually, we don't want to see these lads playing until October when the Champions Cup starts again?
But of course they can, and that's, I think, even... their the ability, you know, and Ireland won the Grand Slam yesterday, and the IRFU have to take a huge amount of credit because of the way they run the game in Ireland. And you know, there's been lots of, since the game went professional, about what the best way is to run the game. And but you only had to look at yesterday. I thought England have a number of really world class players who to me look really tired. Like Atoje, I think, is a great example. This time last year, he was head and shoulders above everyone in certainly in the English pack, and he had a fantastic line series. But he's looked hard the entire Six Nations, and I think a really interesting stat coming into the Six Nations that he had played something like 850 minutes of rugby before the Six Nations started this season, and Tadhg Furlong had played 270 minutes of rugby. And Johnny Sexton played 270 minutes of rugby, and that's the problem when you're serving two masters. You've got to play when you're told to play. Whereas Ireland have control of the players, so it's not impossible to think that that by the time Ireland even get to go to Australia, that Johnny Sexton won't have played a huge amount of rugby. He's played a lot clearly in the Six Nations the last 5 weeks or 8 weeks, whatever. He's racked up a lot, and now we're getting to the business end of Europe, and you would expect Leinster to be close to having a good run, though obviously anything can happen.
Well, I'm just looking at the calendar here. We play in Brisbane on the 9th of June. If Leinster have made a Champions Cup final in Bilbao on May 12th, I don't think that is enough of a turnaround for a guy who'll have played a good bit of rugby, battered and bruised as he walked off that field yesterday. The linchpin of this team. I just don't see the benefits of Johnny Sexton. Even if we go down there and win and play well, I don't see the overall.
Well, you do potentially have a Pro 14 final 2 weeks after that, May 26th as well. So,
like, there's no need for it. In the one position, perhaps, and we've been talking about hooker and scrum half, but really 10, where we just don't have a guy that you're happy to come in and do the job right now. Mainly because Sexton has been so good and he's been injury free this time around, that Joey Carberry, Ross Byrne, Ian Keighley, whoever it might be, they are not getting any time, consistent time in big tests from the start in the 10 jersey. So what an opportunity.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that there's a great opportunity to have all those players have a shot and play international rugby in the year before the World Cup. I think both arguments are sound to have the momentum and to keep going with having Sexton and Murray involved, or to not have them involved. I don't think you're going to... I think you'll get
what
a result both ways. What would I do? I don't know. There would be a lot of value in leaving them behind, but you know, winning is important as well, and they want to make sure that they keep winning. And with that halfback combination, they give themselves a better chance of winning. So you know, I wouldn't underestimate the value. It's not a development tour going on. They go to Australia to play three tests. Yeah. So
are we getting close to being in a position we can go to Australia without those two and win?
I certainly think, you know, the team is strong. It's as strong as it's ever been. The squad is strong. So you know, they'll no matter who they're playing, home or away, Ireland are competitive. And whether they have if they had this 15 starting from yesterday or a variation of it, they'd be competitive no matter who they're playing or where they're playing. So I've plenty of confidence in that element. But I don't know. I don't know. I really don't.
We might fly through the back line. What's Ireland's best centre partnership?
I don't know that. I really don't know the answer to that. I think it's great to see Ringrose come back and play in two big games, and he was better again against England than he had been against Scotland, which is expected after being out for so long. And he's clearly he's going to hit form at the right time now, certainly for Leinster. If you're looking at Leinster, he's come back, played in two big games. He was very competitive yesterday, very abrasive. He's certainly someone who Ireland are going to be able to build an attack and defence around, and I think but I think Farrell has been excellent every time he's played for Ireland. He was very unlucky not to be in a position to get picked for the last two games. But you know, they've a lot of competition there. Bundiaki clearly performed in his first Six Nations, and Henshaw, and there's a couple of others as well. So again, it's an area where Ireland have a lot of options, which is great.
You were talking about Keith Earls off air, and maybe somewhat overshadowed in ways by Jacob Stockdale and just the sensational try-scoring run he's gone on in the Six Nations. Earls, the way he's changed from when he first started out with Ireland to the role he has in the team now, have you seen that?
Yeah, he's a real leader now. You can clearly see he's one of the elder, again, one of the elder statesmen in the team, and he has become more comfortable clearly with his leadership role. But I just thought throughout the Six Nations, not just yesterday, he's been one of Ireland's really consistent performers. He's really aggressive with and without the ball. He's really good in the air going forward, which is a key skill you got to have with the Joe Schmidt game plan. His acceleration is undiminished by age, which you would expect. He's one of the older guys, but he's not old. And his acceleration yesterday, when I thought he made the right decision to try to come in and stop the ball, and just, you know, it was excellent pass by the English back line, just missed Evan slightly, but the fact that he was able to turn and still catch Elliot Daly with a tap tackle, you know, really,
well,
really
turning
quick.
As well, when you look back at the footage, he's turning before the ball arrives in Elliot Daly's hands.
He realizes he's missed it. Yeah, exactly. And he's turning. He hasn't given up. And that's, I think that's kind of, that sums him up really, because he's competitive right to the end. He chases every kick, chases every ball in the air. He is perfectly happy in the physical stuff, and he's been a leader out, himself and Rob Kearney, two experienced heads with the young Stockdale on the other wing, has made for a very strong Irish back three.
Even one of the iconic moments in a tournament of many of them was Keith Earls' pursuit of, was it Benvenuti in the last couple of minutes against Italy, in a game that was already done. We were beating them by 30 odd points, and he's got the desire to cover that ground and put in a try-saving tackle. That kind of just summed up how well he played in this tournament.
And we did come into this tournament with people questioning the back three and what the best selection was be, and a lot of talk of Simon Zeebo and the outrage that he wasn't allowed to be involved in this campaign. That's gone very quiet. And you touched on Rob Kearney there. He was at the centre of an awful lot of that attention under huge pressure from Jordan Larmour at full back, but stepped up again and again and again.
Mm.
Is that it? All questions answered ahead of 2019?
I don't think the just because the back three have played very well, the Simon Zeebo question wasn't valid. You know, I think the fact that he was omitted was very, very hard, considering he's still playing in Ireland. But putting that aside, I think there was a lot of questions about who the best back three were going to be. Even after November, it wasn't immediately clear who Schmidt would pick going into the Six Nations, but each one of those three have been immense in every game. I think Rob Kearney has had one of the best seasons he's ever had for Ireland, and that can happen. You know, you can have a career with the length duration that Rob has had and the success he's had. You know, he's got two Grand Slams.
He's the most successful player in the history of Irish rugby.
Yeah, three Heineken Cups.
He's
won everything, really, and he's been on the lines a couple of times as well. He's an incredibly decorated player. So the fact he still has the hunger, inevitably he was going to get injured at some stage during his career, the fact he's bounced back, and you know, he was really written off at one point. He was given very little respect, I thought, considering the career he had. He was finished. He was no good. He wasn't up to it. He was going to get replaced by everyone. And he kept his counsel and just got on with getting better. And he played, you know, away from the lights and just kept getting better and better for Leinster. And he's been so solid this year for Ireland. And his attacking game, his counter-attacking game, has been the strongest it's ever been. He's so hard to stop, the way he spins out of the tackle. And he always gets that extra yard. And he's been a real calming influence at the back. And I was delighted to see him play so well this year.
So, to wrap up, and we'll let you go after this, where's Joe Schmidt going to be looking at for Ireland to improve between now and next year's Six Nations and now in the World Cup?
Say that again.
Where's Joe Schmidt going to be looking? What areas of the pitch can Ireland really go and improve in?
Well, like I think he'll... I don't know. Like, I don't know Joe Schmidt. I never was coached by him, but he doesn't strike me as someone who won't have had a notebook full of things he believes that Ireland didn't get right in the Six Nations. I think he'll see lots of things that they have to improve on, which is, you know, I think in every one of their games they had patches in the game when they didn't perform as well as they could have. And it was a strength. It was obviously a testimony to both their skill level and their character. They were always able to win those close games. But there was plenty to work on from all those games. And I think he'll focus on two things. He'll focus on continuing to develop the leadership capability within the team and bringing those younger players through. He'll focus on the squad rather than the team and making sure he has two or three options in in every position, which again has been the hallmark of his reign, is that we've had rarely been able to field the team that we've wanted, that we've probably on paper wanted to be able to field up till maybe the last couple of rounds of the Six Nations, last round of the Six Nations. But so I think he'll focus on bringing players through and making sure that some of the areas that we talked about that maybe Ireland have a little less clarity on who the third choice player might be. I think he'll focus on that, and I think he'll focus on managing his players. I think he'll make sure that he controls who is available to play, and as we get closer and closer to the World Cup, having that ability to determine how those resources are used is going to be a key factor in determining how successful Ireland, because not every team can do that. That's a strategic advantage that Ireland have, and they've got to be able to leverage that to make sure in their position to perform to the best in the World Cup.
We've never got to a World Cup semi-final, so last question, Dennis, because it's something I was talking to a couple of people about yesterday. Expectation. We are now the second ranked team in the world. We really, New Zealand is the only team that we would feel on any given day we may struggle to beat. So we should be targeting a World Cup final, should we not? Like, is even the way Joe Schmidt can control all the controllables better than any coach we've ever had, how does he manage the expectation? Because we've seen in previous World Cups, 07 in particular, where we maybe as fans and pundits and commentators lose the run of ourselves.
Well, he can't do a lot about that. He can't do a lot about people outside the team losing the run of themselves, and that's a national fault as opposed to anything to do with the Irish, to do anything with the Irish team. And probably coming from New Zealand, he probably finds that difficult to get to grips with. But that's going to happen anyway. I think what this team has been very comfortable with is dealing with the weight of expectation. They've rarely, if ever, apart from that last World Cup, and they're a very different team, even I'd say, mentally than they were at that World Cup. But since that day, they've been able to deal with all expectations. So I think they're very well placed to do that. But yeah, it's going to be a job to be able to manage that. We've another whole Six Nations cycle to go through, and a lot can happen.
Yeah, just like, look at England.
All you have to do is look at England. They went into this tournament 22 out of 23 games won in a row. The last, only Ireland had beat them in the Six Nations. They'd won 22 out of the 23. And
everything been questioned now.
And everything has been questioned now. So things can unravel very quickly. And I don't think that'll be lost on either Joe Schmidt or any of the players for that matter. So I think they'll just continue, as they say, to focus on the process and focus on the next game. And while that might seem like media speaks to keep everything lit on it, I think they found a way to manage expectations amongst themselves and to focus on the bigger picture while navigating the individual hurdles along the way, and I think they're well positioned to do that.
A little bit more work for Joe Schmidt to do, because Romania have been confirmed as being in Ireland's group for the World Cup. Belgium beat Spain earlier today, so that means Romania are going to be in Ireland's group. Controversy at the end, though, the referee was Romanian. So we'll find out a little
bit. Don't know how that works.
We'll give you a little bit of time to conduct some analysis on the Romanians before we start asking you what sort of a challenge they're going to pose.
We expect 300 pages of written notes.
Well, I think we know one man who'll certainly have it. Brilliant stuff, Dennis. Thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today. All our Six Nations coverage on Off the Ball is with thanks to Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us. There is, despite the snow, quite a bit of live sport going on in Gaelic football, in hurling, and in the FA Cup. We'll run you down through all that in a moment. And we still have plenty more rugby to come as well. Our Sunday pay-per-view coming up shortly with Hugh Farrelly and Dan McDonnell.
The Six Nations on Off the Ball with Vodafone. Official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. We all belong to the team of us.